The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.
Good evening and welcome to Crime and Justice Radio, where we talk all things murder, mayhem in the courts with expert insiders and legal outcasts. I'm Bruce Barquette. I am your host for this evening. Ms. Leisenring has the evening off. She's been doing a lot of that over the course of the summer. Hopefully, she's enjoying herself. Great show for you tonight. We have two guests. And typical of what we do, we're trying to do something a little practical and then somewhat theoretical. We have Danya Perry, who's going to come up at the bottom of the hour. She's a former federal prosecutor, brilliant lawyer, worked in the Southern District of New York for 13 years, I believe, and runs her own law firm now. On national media regularly, she's going to talk about Trump, federal subpoenas, special masters, and even a little bail reform. And then in this half hour, we're going to have Stephen Epstein, who is one of our partners at Barquette Epstein. He's actually the Epstein from Barquette Epstein, who is a nationally renowned expert in vehicular crimes, DWIs, and the like. And he's going to chat with us about marijuana, its use, and how the upcoming distribution, sale, and widespread use of marijuana is going to affect driving while intoxicated laws and how they're going to be enforced, because you don't have a simple, you know, you're over 0.08 with marijuana. But I'll let Steve talk about that some. He'll be up just in a few minutes. I want to start with Eileen Cannon. Ms. Cannon, and I should say Judge Cannon, is the Southern Florida U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Florida, the judge who granted Trump's request for a special master. And certainly we'll get into the details of this a little bit later with Danya Perry. But I want to start off by talking about that and a few other things. She was appointed by Trump in 2020 with, dare say, thin credentials. She was 39 years old, had worked as a U.S. attorney for a number of years, and had worked as an associate in a law firm and clerk for a judge. But not the kind of breadth and depth of experience one might expect to see for a federal judge. And, of course, she was appointed by Trump and then issued this ruling granting him the right to have a different judge, Judge John Deary from the Eastern District in New York, who those of us who practice in this district know quite well, who's going to be the special master and come in and review all the proceeds or the fruits of the search warrant that was executed. And I guess I'm going to talk about this in the context of judges and the two huge rulings that came down from the Supreme Court this summer and spring, which were on abortion and guns. And what I've said about that before, and I'll say again, is the most striking thing about those rulings is they weren't the least bit surprising. And not because the constitutional merit was so obvious, because of course they weren't. The bitterly fought issues for decades over the right to bear arms and over abortion. But it was not surprising that these judges, this group of Supreme Court justices, voted the way they did because of the politics of it. In the same way, I have to wonder about how surprising it was that Ms. or Judge Cannon went out on a limb to help out and grant extraordinary relief to the individual that appointed her to the bench. And, you know, Trump had previously moved to disqualify or recuse a judge that was hearing one of his cases that ended up getting dismissed because that individual was appointed by Bill Clinton. And you wonder whether or not he would apply the same standard to himself. And of course he didn't. And he went and some say judge shopped, forum shopped, went and filed the case where it would be very likely that Judge Cannon would get it. She got it and ended up granting this relief, which really is extraordinary. Those of us who do this work, our clients' offices, homes, computers get searched and seized all the time. And invariably, especially with the way data is kept nowadays in computers and in document form, the government ends up taking a much broader group of materials than that which is going to be legally relevant to whatever they happen to be investigating. It's a huge net that gets cast and brings in a lot of material. Ultimately, the government goes through it and returns, well, they give you copies of everything once the case is commenced, but they return the items that are irrelevant or somehow privileged. And the way they determine whether or not items are privileged is they have their own filter team or taint team that go through the material and separate from the prosecutors and determine, is this privileged? Is it somehow not subject to disclosure to the government? And if so, then they return it and the prosecution team never sees it. All of my clients would love to see a special master appointed so that the government can't look at the materials for which they've obtained a search warrant. And understand how dramatic this is. So the government goes in to a magistrate and says, we have probable cause that a crime is being committed or has been committed, and that evidence of that crime, and a serious crime in this case from what they've alleged, evidence of this crime can be found in this location. And then they go in and take the material, execute the search warrant, gather the material, which furthers their investigation. And instead of being able to use the fruits of the warrant, was granted to them by a judge who no doubt obviously knew that they were searching the former president's home, knew that they were going to gather materials just by the nature of it. They couldn't sit in Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort and go through the materials there, but we're going to go through them back at their office, would go through the materials and find stuff that wasn't relevant and return it. Instead, they've been stopped from even looking into materials until a special master comes in and decides who's going to do what for whom. So really an extraordinary, in my view, relief granted by this particular judge. And I'll be very curious when we pick up at the bottom of the half hour with Danya Perry to discuss this some more, as well as some other issues. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about our new marijuana laws in New York, which marijuana is now legal, will be legal in New York. You can use it. You can get a license to grow it, to package it, to sell it. So not too distant future, you're going to be able to walk into a retail store and pick up marijuana cigarettes, those chewable, edible marijuana devices, but food or whatever they are, to be able to digest or ingest marijuana. And then you're going to be able to drive home, similar to picking up a six-pack of beer. The difference, of course, is that if you pick up a six-pack of beer, you go home, you drink a beer, you can have a beer without becoming intoxicated. You can have a glass of wine with dinner without becoming intoxicated. Marijuana, on the other hand, takes you from 0 to 100 really quickly. Nobody's having a couple of puffs of a marijuana cigarette and not becoming high or intoxicated. So how does the government, how do the police enforce the laws that prohibit people from driving under the influence or driving while their ability is impaired by the use of alcohol? We know we have readings and tests. How about with marijuana, where there aren't any tests? And to that end, I want to introduce one of my partners, Steve Epstein, who is a nationally known and nationally well-regarded attorney on vehicular crime. Steve, are you with us?
I am. Thank you for having me tonight.
Great. So tell us, how are these laws going to get enforced? Very short amount. I mean, obviously, people have been using marijuana for a while illegally and driving, but it's going to become more prevalent with its legality. How do the police, you pull somebody over and you think they might be intoxicated, they don't have any alcohol in their breath, but they may have been smoking marijuana. What do the police do? What do the individuals do?
Well, it's interesting, Bruce, because when the statute was enacted creating a controlled marketplace, one of the concerns of the legislature was, how are we going to protect the roadways, recognizing that it already was a problem on the roadways. You know, the standardized field-side sobriety tests that most people know of were validated in the 1980s and 90s but only for alcohol. It wasn't ever validated for marijuana. So what weapons do the government have to make probable cause determinations? An officer, once they complete the SFST program and they get certified to administer the three standardized tests, the horizontal gaze nystagmus, the walk and turn, and the one-leg stand, their next step of training...
Sorry. Yeah, go ahead. Just walk us through that a little bit. Walk and turn, people have the... What were the other tests?
So the tests are done in order. There's three phases to a DWI investigation. There's the operation phase, what the officer observes the person doing on the roadway. There's personal contact, what the officer then hears, smells, sees, and observes during the request for the person to come out of the vehicle. And then the third phase is what we call the testing phase. It has two components. It has the standardized field sobriety tests and a preliminary breath test, or what's called the PBT. Those three tests are known as the SFST, standardized field sobriety test, and they're done in a specific order. Horizontal gaze nystagmus, which is a test of the person's eyes to see if the muscles are impacted because alcohol is a central nervous system depressant. So it essentially causes an involuntary jerking of the eyes. Then they do a walk and turn test, which is a divided attention test. The idea is when you operate a motor vehicle, you have to be able to pay attention to many different things at the same time. So it tests an individual's ability to listen to, follow the instructions, and then actually engage in this in nine steps in one direction, heel to toe, and then back. And then the last is called the one-leg stand, which is also a physical coordination test. Those tests, when they were validated in the 1980s and 1990s, they gave the individuals alcohol, not drugs. So they were never validated for drugs. Our focus had always been on alcohol because ever since the passage of the 21st Amendment and the elimination of prohibition, society's concern, its moral compass, if you will, was focused on alcohol. Drugs were around, but there weren't any ways to test for it.
So what happens now with marijuana?
So what's happening now is officers are being trained on other methods of detection in the field. And what's going to happen is the taxes that are collected from the legalization of marijuana hopefully will be used to make our streets even safer. Officers have already been trained under what's called the A-Ride protocol, which is advanced roadside impairment. That's not actually does not give them the ability to make a conclusion that somebody's under the influence of a particular drug. It just gives them a little bit of education. It's a two-day class. The real methodology that officers are being trained under is called the DRE protocol, and it's a 12-step process. To take that class, officers go to attend it for 2 weeks, and they learn a substantial amount of material about how to do this 12-step DRE protocol, which eventually will give them the ability to draw an opinion as to whether or not somebody's under the influence of a particular drug. There is also a similar test to the PBT that's being used right now. In fact, it's being used in Nassau County by Nassau County Police Department, and it has for a period of time, and that's a saliva test. For example, Draeger has a test called the Draeger 5000, and the officers can collect a sample of saliva in the field and almost immediately know whether or not the screening test shows the presence of marijuana in the person's system.
So at the end of the day, somebody gets pulled over, and what they're going to introduce the results of these field sobriety tests or standardized field sobriety tests into evidence in prosecuting them for driving under the influence of marijuana?
Yeah, and it actually just applies to all drugs as well. The first thing that's going to happen is the police are going to engage in a traffic stop and see that there's something wrong. The person's conduct is not consistent with sobriety. So the first thing they're going to do is that PBT that I was telling you about, or a breath test, which is going to determine that there's no alcohol on board. And that's when the officers are going to direct their attention in other ways. Now, obviously, there's also the classic scenario where in Cheech and Chong movies, the officer opens up the door and a puff of smoke comes out of the car, right? But if a person is sitting there and there's a marijuana, joint in the ashtray, or they can smell the odor of marijuana and it's very strong, their attention is going to get focused immediately to a particular drug, and in that case, marijuana.
Right.
But generally, most often, it's the result of an investigation of alcohol that turns up to be a person being sober.
So, but you said that these tests are meant to detect the use of a wide range of drugs. Wouldn't people have different symptoms, if you will, or different manifestations of their intoxication if they've used heroin, cocaine, marijuana, ecstasy, or some other drug?
That's That's right. That's why there's a DRE matrix, and there's a matrix of drugs and classifications of drugs that will generate different types of responses. For example, during the 12-step DRE protocol, they do a preliminary examination of the person's pulse. They do the horizontal gaze nystagmus test. They do vital signs. They actually will look for muscle tone, things of that nature, look for injection sites. So there's a series of different things they do, and they have a chart or what's called a DRE matrix that will point them in different directions for different classifications of drugs depending upon what they observe.
So I'm going to ask the question everybody who's listening wants to know. You get pulled over, you're at a party, you had a little bit of marijuana, nothing to drink, and the officer pulls you over and asks you to get out of the car and start taking these tests. Do you do them? Do you do them or not?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a hard answer to give you generically, and I'll tell you the interesting thing is that most often the myth that's in the public sector is you refuse, and that's generally not the right answer. For many different reasons. Somebody who refuses to submit to a chemical test, for example, let's say for alcohol, is going to wind up with a revocation of their driver's license for a year. And I have represented several individuals who were completely sober, who refused the breath test because they were advised by people that they know to never take the breath test because they can't rely upon it. I think, you know, the first thing is you have to make a determination of where you are in the spectrum. If you're innocent and you're not under the impairing effects of any drugs or alcohol, cooperate with the police and take the test. But I'll tell you this, more importantly than anything else, and what most people don't know, is that when you're arrested, as you know, you're not at that point, you don't have the right to an attorney, a substantive right. But there's this limited right in New York that if you're being investigated for determining whether or not your ability was impaired by alcohol or drugs, you have this right to ask for the opportunity to take your cell phone and to call a lawyer and have a conversation with about what you should do in that circumstance.
So wait a second. Does this right exist on the street? So you get pulled over and somebody says, okay, get out of the car. I want you to look at this pen while I do the
Yes, it does.
I want you to look at the pen as I wave it back and forth in front of your face. I want you to walk in a straight line. I want you to do this and that. And you can say to the officer, officer, would you just give me a moment? I'd like to consult with my lawyer before I decide whether or not I'm taking any of these tests.
Yeah, and that's the key language there. You have to actually request the opportunity to call your lawyer or somebody that you can be in touch with. The police do not have to advise you that you have the right to counsel, and they do not in New York have to provide counsel for you. In other states, such as Vermont, they actually have an attorney that's on call 24 hours a day to take those phone calls. But in New York, you have to have that relationship with the lawyer ahead of time. Have that person's name and phone number in your cell phone. There's case law in New York that if you have the cell phone accessible, they have to give it to you so that you could find the person's contact information and give them a call.
Right there on the street, you can call, or in your car, you call your lawyer if you know one and ask for advice on whether or not you should take the test.
Take the tests.
Right. And obviously when you get to the precinct and they're asking you to take a breath test for alcohol, you can call for that as well.
Right. Well, that's the real critical time to make that decision, because the PBT that's done in the field, let's say we're talking about alcohol for a second, the result of that PBT is not admissible. Those are only for probable cause determinations. Now, the standardized field site sobriety tests are, but they're less important than the breath test. That breath test or a blood test, if you're being asked to give a blood sample, they could ask for breath, blood, urine, or saliva under the VTL. That's the critical determination, whether you give that sample. And I would recommend that if you're unsure what to do, try to reach out to an attorney.
You know any good lawyers?
Somebody's. I do.
So give, and look, all kidding aside, people should absolutely call for lawyers. Individuals who get pulled over and get in situations who are basically law-abiding think that if they ask for a lawyer, it makes them appear guilty. And officers may even say something like that to you. Don't take the bait. Ask to call for a lawyer. Getting investigated for anything from a serious federal offense to DWI is like a sharp pain in your chest. It may be nothing. Then again, it may be dramatic and something. If you had a sharp pain in your chest, you'd go to a doctor. If you're being investigated for a crime, you should call a lawyer at the earliest possible point. And one of the great lawyers in the country, and literally and certainly in New York, for vehicular crimes, everything from vehicular manslaughters, vehicular accidents or crashes, as they're called, all the way down to DWIs, is Steve Epstein. You can read more about him at our site. It's BarquetteEpstein.com. And you can certainly give him a call. Our number, main number in Garden City, is 516-745-1500. That's the infomercial for you and for our firm for tonight. Steve, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, Bruce. I greatly appreciate it.
And you can follow us on Crime and Justice Radio on our social media platforms. Be sure to follow us on our social media platforms. Crime and Justice Radio on Instagram. Crime Justice FM on Twitter. And Crime and Justice Radio on Facebook. I hope I got that right. Feel free. And you can always listen to the shows after they've aired. Go to BarquetteEpstein.com and click on Crime and Justice Radio. You'll be able to hear the shows. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Danya Perry, who will talk to us about some national issues involving our former president, Donald J. Trump. Appreciate it. Stick around. Just a couple of messages. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Crime and Justice Radio. This is Bruce Barquette, your host for this evening. And I'm really delighted to introduce Danya Perry, who is a former federal prosecutor for the Southern District of New York. And if you know federal prosecutors, the Southern District of New York is kind of like the New York Yankees of of U.S. attorney's offices across the country. It is the place you want to work. She's a graduate from Harvard College and Yale Law School. Loves the Ivy League, obviously. Has her own law firm now that's run completely and owned completely by minorities and females, and is nationally known expert in this industry. She has been on MSNBC, CNN, BBC, and so forth. So we're really privileged to have her. Danya, welcome.
Thank you, Bruce. It's so nice to be here. If only just to have the opportunity to speak with you again, but really.
Oh, that's right. Well, do you remember the last thing you ever said to me?
No.
In court?
Please don't tell everybody.
It'll be. Well, I have to say this because it was a line that stung me when I heard it. I had just given a thunderous summation in a case, and you stood up for rebuttal and said, if a lawyer has the facts against him, he pounds the law. If he has a law against him, he pounds the facts. And if the law and facts are both against him, he pounds the table. And therein went all of my passion and all of my efforts went right down the drain with that line. So
you're a most worthy adversary. You were always, always showed incredible integrity and incredible grit and just incredible skill and talent. So it was always, everyone at the U.S. Attorney's office was fearful when your name came on the other side of the docket. But
you guys at the Southern District, nobody, you don't fear anyone. So you know what I want to do? I want to talk a little bit about my newest application for every one of my clients who has a search warrant executed where their computers are taken, documents are taken, doctor's offices, lawyer's offices, businessmen, and so forth. I think I'm just going to ask for a special master and stop the investigation in its tracks and have some senior judge from whatever district around the country come in and review all the documents for months, and then we'll figure out from there what should happen. What do you think?
Well, depending on who your client is and whether you have the ability to forum and judge shop, you might be in luck, because it does seem there's a new trend. It may just be for a party of one, who is entitled to this kind of special treatment, but we'll see if it actually sets any precedent. There's already appeal pending or a limited appeal pending to at least stay part of the order that was entered into by the Southern District of Florida Judge Aileen Cannon with respect to the Trump search warrant. So we'll see if that sticks. My bet is that it will not. Because in my opinion, I don't think it's grounded seriously in the law or any precedent.
So I want you to talk a little bit as kind of an, not kind of, but as an insider And first, talk about the scrutiny that U.S. attorneys have to get or agents have to get before they search, say, a lawyer's office or a politician's offices. I think the public has this general perception that search warrants are there for the asking, and you give a buddy your call, the judge that you, you know, a drinking buddy, and you call them up and say, hey, I need a warrant for this, and they say, no problem. But I know that's not how it goes. From your perspective, having obtained these kinds of warrants, what's the scrutiny? What's the process?
Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of loose language around it. It's often referred to kind of colloquially as a raid. Just seems like, you know, kind of a document grab. But no, as you allude to, there's a tremendous amount of process that goes into it. And particularly when you're talking about a lawyer's office, there's extra levels of scrutiny. And I know that both from my time at the U.S. Attorney's Office when I was involved in signing off on these kinds of things and sending them off to main justice. And then on the other side, I represented a couple lawyers, including Michael Avenatti, Michael Cohen, and I've been involved in some other cases, including the Giuliani investigation. So I'm certainly aware of all the cases that the government is put to in order to get one of these things done. There's, you know, layers of review within the U.S. Attorney's Office and the law enforcement agency that's swearing out the warrant. And then there's layers of review within the U.S. Attorney's Office as well. So it has to go up to main justice and then a particular arm of the Justice Department that has to sign off when there's a lawyer's office involved in particular. And here with these, we know they were raised up to the Trump search warrants in particular was raised up to the highest levels within the Department of Justice and the FBI. And then, of course, was signed off on by a magistrate, a federal magistrate court judge, who had to find necessarily that there was probable cause to execute the warrant. So it's a whole process. And here, you know, it clearly was done, you know, following meticulously every step of the way. They didn't want any missteps. Right. So it's it's not a slapdash, you know, kind of
right. The process, you know, the process as you're describing it is, first of all, within your own group, whoever's doing it, they realize the gravity of what they're suggesting. We're going to search the home or the resort of the immediate former president, the one who was president just a few years ago, and then it goes through the U.S. Attorney's Office where whatever district is prosecuting it, and a separate process with the Department of Justice. And this is all before it ever sees the light of day in front of a judge.
Yeah, correct. So there's a lot of layers of review and scrutiny and, you know, checking work.
And so what happens typically to clients that I would represent or you might represent who aren't former presidents when they get raided, if you will, or a search is executed at their home or their business, and they're claiming that material is privileged, that they've had communications with lawyers, or otherwise private or just simply irrelevant to the nature of the investigation? How does that get normally processed out within law enforcement?
So typically, with an ordinary search warrant that's executed at, you know, lay people's homes or their phones or their place of work, there's just a, you know, kind of ordinary garden variety review. And if it becomes clear, or if the investigator suspects that there might be some privileged documents within the search, they will get a search review team, a taint team, you know, that will look to see if there's any privileged documents. When the investigators know that there is likely to be privileged documents, they will lay out a roadmap, a plan for the magistrate judge to sign off on that will have a, you know, pretty strict plan in place already to review documents that might be privileged. And more recently, there has been more of a trend to have a special master appointed as a third party, particularly when we are talking about a lawyer's offices or their electronic devices, and particularly when it's high profile. So we have seen special masters appointed in the Michael Cohen search, in the Giuliani search, and a couple others. But typically, these are attorney-client privilege.
Well, you're searching an attorney. Right, you're searching an attorney's office, so inevitably you're going to have privileged material that's going to be found. It's just part of what's in the office.
Some of them might be third parties, but even, you know, if there's, you know, that would have nothing to do with the object of the search or, the criminal statutes on which the search is predicated. So there have to be safeguards in place, and there are, and it really kind of depends sometimes. The defendant doesn't ask for a third-party monitor or master. Sometimes they do, and then the judge can decide. But again, this really is, you know, with well-established types of privilege, really typically attorney-client. I'm not aware of any case, and, you know, obviously a lot of this is unprecedented, where one of the claimed privileges is executive privilege. So this is kind of making some new law. And again, we'll see if it's upheld by the 11th Circuit that it's on appeal.
Yeah, no, that'll be the results of that certainly will be interesting. So you mentioned Michael Cohen, who was Trump's longtime fixer and lawyer, who his office himself was raided. He did some time in federal prison, and you represented him for a bit. And he's a huge fan of yours on social media, praises you all the time, and I guess rightly so. What did you participate in getting him released and allowing him to continue to speak publicly about matters concerning Trump?
Yeah, that's exactly the piece of his case that I was involved in. I was not involved in the underlying criminal prosecution and conviction, but he was sentenced, I believe, in 2018, and was released not too long after the pandemic started, because of health concerns. And, you know, a lot of federal prisoners were released at the time due to COVID concerns. And he had significant longstanding documented health issues. So he was released to home confinement. And at some point, he was requested to sign several conditions for his continued release, and that would have included a complete prior restraint on his First Amendment right to talk freely about his experiences with the former president. He had posted on social media and kind of trumpeted about that he was about to publish a tell-all book in advance of the 2020 elections. And that apparently got the attention of prosecutors or investigators. And so they tried to get him to sign these conditions of continued release. And he questioned it and was kind of unceremoniously shackled and thrown into solitary confinement. Upstate in Otisville. It happened to be during a time of a terrific heat wave. I think it was, you know, 110 degrees in his room. And he was kept in there for a couple weeks before we were able to get him out. We filed a motion for an injunction before a federal district court judge and got him out.
And got him out and let him talk about whatever he wanted to talk about, which was...
Yeah.
So that
fit all those conditions.
So how have you? I know that you were a federal prosecutor for a long time, and you worked for large organizations. You're now a founding partner in your own. And I say your own firm. You have a partner and a number of lawyers that work for you. How have you found private practice to be? How do you enjoy it? Do you like it?
I love it. It kind of was an obvious next step. I was in the federal government as a prosecutor, and then I went over to state government for a bit. And then I went into private practice as an in-house lawyer, as a head of litigation for a private equity company. Classic, I needed the money kind of a story, but I was trying to get my bearings. I was going through a divorce. I was a single mom of three young kids, trying to figure out what I wanted to do next. It ended up being a great experience where I learned a lot about client service and a lot about civil litigation, which I had never really done before. But after some time of that, once I kind of got my bearings, I just wanted to get back in the courtroom again. I wanted to be on my feet again. I wanted to be a real lawyer again.
And so you have. It looks like you guys, you all have done spectacularly well with a variety of different kinds of cases. You've certainly got notoriety from it. You mentioned the state system. You were general counsel to the Moreland Commission. Is that right?
Yeah, I was the chief of investigations.
So let's just remind people what that was. That a number of years ago, before Silver and Skelos were indicted, Cuomo set up a commission, or maybe it was right around the time they were indicted, but set up a commission to investigate state corruption in New York, and it started to get some traction. Stuff started to happen, and then suddenly it shut down. What was your perspective of that?
Yeah, I've gone on the record about this. There was a New Yorker article that kind of laid this all out, but it's kind of exactly what you said. Our mission was to try and root out the causes and suggest reforms for why we were one of the most politically corrupt states in the country, and to refer any criminal matters if we uncovered any. We had subpoena power, power to compel. There are a lot of investigative powers. We were deputized by the Attorney General to do so. And we had a great run. We hired some incredible investigators. We had a great team. And we were, as you say, getting a lot of traction. But I guess we uncovered too much, and it began to get politically uncomfortable for some of the people in power.
For who? Politically uncomfortable?
I mean, the governor in particular. Did not like how close we were getting. I'm not implying that he himself was corrupt or anything like that, but just that there was a deeply entrenched system in place. He was a beneficiary of that system. And a lot, you know, I don't want to say too much, but a lot of it is still in the books and it's still lawful. You know, there's a lot of dark money in politics. There's a lot of workarounds, and you know, you can have other sources of income. You know, a lot of it has come out since then, as you pointed out. The two leaders of the legislature were later indicted, convicted, and served time. You know, based on investigations that we had begun, but that were, you know, that were attempted at least to be swept under the rug, but they, you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office, my old office, swept in and swept house.
They used to say three men in the room, but two of them ended up being in a cell and not a room. And then we know what happened with the governor, Cuomo. He moved on, but so far has avoided any kind of prosecution. And I'm not implying either that he did something illegal. But I think your point is well taken, that he the workarounds, if you will, were areas that you could have identified and said we could do better in this state. And when that started to happen, it ended. One last topic I want you to touch on. Bail reform is everywhere these days. Every day I pick up the paper, you see another article of another individual. I guess yesterday or today is the axe-wielding table smasher in a McDonald's somewhere in Manhattan. And people are screaming about the fact that there's not cash bail in New York anymore for a whole range of crimes. And I don't want you to talk so much about the state system, but I want you to talk about the federal system, which you're intimately familiar. And generally speaking, there's not cash bail in the federal system, right? You can do it, but generally people sign bonds, have strict conditions and strict supervision. They're not being held in federal detention centers because they can't come up with a few thousand dollars. Can you talk about the system kind of generally?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. Federal judges cannot set quote unquote unreasonable bail. They can detain defendants if they are a public danger or if there's reason to believe that the defendant is a flight risk. They can either detain the defendant or if they believe that there's a set of conditions that would keep the defendant in place pending trial, they can set the least restrictive conditions possible, and that's statutory. And so it can be anything from releasing the defendant on his or her own recognizance to releasing with certain conditions, including it could be monitoring, you know, whether ankle or strict supervision. But yeah, it's rarely cash. I mean, it can be, it can be a large bond, and that can be secured sometimes by cash, but oftentimes, you know, in the form of property, real or otherwise.
Or other people signing off on the bond.
Or other people, yeah, that so, you know, either have moral suasion and or have, you know, some means of financial means that to keep the defendant in place.
Right. Now, and look, I don't think that the federal system is very strict. The individuals are detained, I don't want to say regularly, but there's nobody's shy about doing it. But they don't have people, what's the problem with the state system, they didn't have people in detention pretrial for lack of funds. They didn't have people sitting in jail who otherwise would have been released but didn't have $5,000, $10,000, or $50,000 to post in cash. And I think people should take note of that. In some ways, New York's bail system is somewhat antiquated, and the federal system, while it has some issues, isn't. It's a little bit more modern. We only have another minute or so left. I want to give you a chance to tell us, if we wanted to find you, where do we find you online? Tell us about your firm, its name, website, and so forth.
Oh, yes. Thank you for the plug. Perry Guha LLP. You can see online what our practice is like. It is, as you say, it's a real mix. A lot of criminal defense work, a lot of all kinds of civil litigation on both sides of the aisle. So we do quite a bit of plaintiff's work, and we do a lot of public impact work, prisoners' rights, civil rights, and a lot of, you know, pro bono cases. So,
and you do some employment discrimination as well?
A lot of that.
Excellent, excellent. Danya, thank you so much for coming on. You hear the music, which means we kind of have to go. Appreciate it. Hopefully you'll come back and chat with us again.
Love to.
Appreciate it. And you can follow us on Crime and Justice Radio on our social media platforms, which are Crime and Justice Radio on Instagram, Crime Justice FM on Twitter, and Crime and Justice Radio page on Facebook. Thank you. We'll see you back next week. And Ms. Leisenring is rumored to be here as well. Talk to you then.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.